They had a lieutenant colonel from the Air Force, and he did not identify himself. And he told me, if we just took you out in the jungle, they would never find you out there. You've got to sign these papers. You never saw this. And if you tell anybody, you will just come up missing. It was in late March, early April of 1997 when this happened. The matter is the most highly classified subject in the United States government, rating higher even than the H-bomb. Flying saucers exist. Their modus operandi is unknown, but concentrated effort is being made by a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush. The entire matter is considered by the United States authorities to be of tremendous significance. W. B. Smith. Department of Transport. Canada, senior radio engineer, head of Project Magnet. Memorandum on George Magnetics, November 21, 1950. UFO secret files, subterranean bases, documents, NRO/Central Security Service memorandum. Testimonials, Richard Doty, special agent with Air Force Office of Special Investigations. Master Sergeant Dan Morris, NRO operative, Cosmic Clearance. Sergeant Clifford Stone, U.S. Army Retrieval Unit. William John Paul Eck, U.S. Air Force, Computer Operations and Programming Specialist. Commentary from Stephen M. Greer. In this country during the early 1950s, numerous subterranean bases were built that would allow the President and certain members of his cabinet and Congress to survive a nuclear attack. Mount Weather, Virginia was one of these facilities. Fort Ritchie, Maryland is another, while Wright lies fortified beneath the Cheyenne Mountain Complex in Wyoming. None of these facilities holds a candle to the USAP.UFO/ET subterranean complexes. They were constructed in secrecy by companies like Bechtel Corporation, using a nuclear-powered boring machine that could drill through and glassify bedrock without any rubble to remove. On board these massive subterranean machines is a compact nuclear reactor that circulates liquid lithium from the reactor core to the tunnel face, generating exterior temperatures in excess of 2000 degrees Fahrenheit. That's hot enough to melt rock, so there's no excavated soil or stone left to remove, no telltale evidence. As the lithium loses some of its heat, it's circulated back along the exterior of the subterranean, which cools the vitrified rock, leaving behind a smooth, finished obsidian-like inner core, which is ideal for their maglev trains, which are used in these tunnels and travel at super high speeds, connecting one underground base with another. Where are these secret bases located? While the list is far more extensive, I'll only mention the complexes that I have been to or our witnesses have referenced in their testimonies. The Cube is a state-of-the-art underground facility that Lockheed Martin Skunk Works runs in the high desert near Edwards Air Force Base. One of the main cogs is the subterranean complex beneath Dulles, New Mexico, which is accessible underground from Los Alamos. Back when Bechtel's excavating machine was completing the tunnel from Dulles to Los Alamos, the vibrations in the bedrock caused a humming sound that residents of Taos, New Mexico call the Taos Hum. Some New Agers actually thought it was Gaia speaking to them. Then there's Groom Lake, Nevada and Bagway Proving Grounds in the desert outside Provo, Utah. While there are many international complexes as well, I want to mention one in particular. Pine Gap is located in Australia's Northern Territory. To locals, it is nothing more than a satellite ground station which is jointly operated by the Americans and Aussies. While it appears to be surrounded by mountains, it is actually a hologram that conceals a massive base built deep inside the mountain. While all this may sound like something out of a James Bond movie set, as you'll see in the next few files, these people do not fool around. As an example, one of my military advisors was involved in a USAP where he and a few others were taken into a SIF, a Secure Communication Intelligence, Information Facility. Completely underground. Everyone's weapons were taken, their cell phones, watches, anything electronic. A security enforcement officer for the USAP escorted them. The guy took a bullet out of his gun's chamber and said, "If you tell anyone about anything going on in this project, There is a bullet with your name on it and it will find you, somewhere, somehow. This is not a movie. This is actually how that world works. The world I've lived in since 1993. And it is not your rank that allows one access, but a need to know. The day after the congressional briefings in 1997, I was asked to do a briefing for Admiral Tom Wilson, the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In advance of this important meeting, we sent over a classified NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, document, included in this file, which has the code names and code project names to a number of these unacknowledged special access projects. The Admiral's assistant told me Admiral Wilson had, in fact, found these code names and code project names and numbers useful. He inquired through channels and found some of these black ops in a cell in the Pentagon. Having identified this group, he told the contact person in this super secret cell, "I want to know about this project." He was told, "Sir, you don't have a need to know. We can't tell you." Well, he was shocked and angry. Later, the Admiral and I discussed the risk this rogue group was to the United States, the rule of law and to our national security. I pointed out that the first CIA director, Admiral Ross Kirilenko et al., had written a letter in the early 1960s stating that the secrecy related to UFO's and not the UFO's was a threat to the national security. I told the Admiral that this illegal, rogue group had ARV technology that can do circles around his B-2 stealth bombers. He thought a minute and said, "Well, as far as I am concerned, if you can get people who know about this matter to talk on the record, you have my permission to go to the media with this. This group is illegal." He green-lighted the disclosure project. Translated, there's nothing that I, the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon and an admiral, can do. Testimonial. Richard Doty was a special agent for counterintelligence for the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, AFOSI. For over 8 years, he was specifically tasked with the UFO/extraterrestrial issue at Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico, and also at Nellis Air Force Base, the so-called Area 51, and at other locations. I was at the Nevada Test Site, which is now the Nevada Security Site, what you call Area 51, which was at that time 3 Test Center. When I was out there in 1981 and 1985, it was called the 3 Test Center out of Edwards. Area 51 is actually 2 sites, the 3 Test Site and Groom Lake. And then there is the auxiliary site, Papoose, that has an underground entrance. I spent 9 months out there as a counterintelligence officer. They had a lot of really neat things going out there. We had a facility at the Area 51 site that would shoot a laser up and blind the Soviet satellite cameras as they flew over so they couldn't photograph anything. There are 2 different complexes out there and it was all compartmented. There's one with the alien crafts, and then there's an entirely different area for the reverse engineered, man-made, crafts. The underground facility housed the extraterrestrial crafts. The above-ground facilities in the far end of the complex housed the reverse-engineered, ARV.alien reproduction vehicle, aircraft. While I was out there, I saw an anti-gravity craft. They had the bodies of all sorts of different types of crafts that they were testing that they had put together to try and fly it. A lot of these things didn't work, they had a lot of crashes out there. The contractors that were primarily working on the craft included East Systems, Johnson Systems, Sandia, Livermore, Los Alamos, Tektronix was out there. Motorola. Motorola had a huge facility where they were trying to check on their communications and how the AT communications worked. Lockheed was out there, and Northrop Grumman. Egg and G ran the place at that time. Gene Laskowski was the security chief for Egg and G, and he always called himself the security officer, only he wasn't the security officer. He was briefed into a lot of things. He knew a lot, like Paul McGovern. The site security chief for Area 51 from 1977 to 1991. He was there the whole time. He's retired now. Paul was the director of plans and programs for the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency. He was the third in line under the director of the DIA. While in the underground site, I saw two craft that defied gravity. It was oval-shaped, probably 10 feet by 20 feet. It wasn't very big. It had landing gears that we had put on it, because they didn't fit the structure of that craft. And it had these portals that were almost fluid-like. You'd look at it and it looked like you were looking through water. I never saw the inside of it, only the outside. And then I saw another craft, a huge craft, that was in the Papoose complex. When you first go down into it, it's located in the first bay area on the right-hand side, a huge craft. It looked like an older craft that had crashed because there was damage on it. But the skin of it and everything looked strange. It didn't look like something we would have built. When you enter the Papoose underground complex, you go down the ramp. It's circular, actually like a horseshoe. There are branches off each one of these areas that go all the way around to the southwest corner of Area 51 near Hangar 7. Along the way, there are elevators and there are compartmented shafts that if you don't have the right badge, you can't. And they're all exchange badge systems that you can't get in some of these. You can only get into certain ones. Like I was saying before, if you're working on the alien craft, you're not going to be working on the man-made reverse-engineered craft. In 1980, I was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for a briefing on something entirely different. But while I was there, I asked to be briefed on something that was related to this, and I was taken over to a facility. An underground facility. We walked down steps, a ramp. It was a huge complex. Although I didn't actually see it, I was told later by Ernie Kilistras that they had alien bodies down there, and I later read something in a classified manual about them. Dot. Testimonial. Dan Morris is a retired Air Force career master sergeant who was involved in the extraterrestrial projects for many years. After leaving the Air Force, he was recruited into the Super Secret National Reconnaissance Organization, or NRO, during which time he worked specifically on extraterrestrial connected operations. He had a cosmic top secret clearance, 38 levels above top secret, which, he states, no US president, to his knowledge, has ever held. You know, the South African government admits that they retrieved an ET craft. They don't make any bones about it. They put out a documentary film that has a police sergeant who's saying that they recovered one. It even shows you pictures of the recovery, and so on and so forth. Now, what I've read is that an agreement was made between our government and them. That we would not say anything about them developing and using their first nuclear weapon, that if we couldn't support them in the UN, that we'd keep our mouths shut. And they would give us the TT ship. And we agreed to it, and they did. We sent a C-5A Galaxy over and brought the ship back, as well as the two aliens that they had gotten out of the ship. They went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, where we usually send most of what we recover. There are about 8 levels under the ground, and we stored it there. Testimonial. Sergeant Clifford Stone, U.S. Army, has seen living and dead extraterrestrials himself in his official duties on an army team that retrieved crashed ET crafts. He has been given access to black ops bases and secret access projects. I had just finished my ET retrieval training when a friend of mine stationed at Fort Meade offered to give me a ride to my base at Fort Lee. We discussed UFOs all the way back to Virginia. Several weeks after, I received a request from this person to visit him at Fort Meade. When I arrived, I was told he would be tied up for a while. This person asked me if I had ever been to the Pentagon. As this was my first time, they offered to give me the 25-cent tour. So we went on over. I had a little badge that was given to me, no picture on it. But the guy that was with me, he had a photo ID and he told the guards I was authorized to come with him. He led me to an elevator and we went down, I don't know how many floors, a long way perhaps, because when we stepped out of the elevator we were staring at two monorails. I had no idea there were monorails beneath the Pentagon. They looked like big tubes, rather thick in the center, one on each side. So you had these little monorails with cars that looked like a bullet, where you could see two people in front and two people in back. We got on the one monorail and started to go. It seemed like maybe 20 minutes, but I'm guessing at that because I don't know for sure. When we got out, he says, "Let me show you some interesting sights down this corridor here." So we headed down the corridor and it looked like there was a door at the far end, and as we got closer my guy turned to me and stated, "You know, things aren't always as they seem to be. A lot of people don't know about these underground monorails beneath the Pentagon. It's just like that wall behind you, it doesn't seem like a wall." I looked at the wall behind me, I thought he was trying to make a joke. There were no seams or anything else I can see. Then he pushed me. I tried to grab myself, but there was actually a door that opened. Through the door there was a field table there. And behind the field table you had this little gray alien. The entity was a little bigger than the 3 to 3.5 feet tall these entities are oftentimes reported to be. But there were two men on either side of the table slightly behind the creature. I looked right into its eyes. It's like you are seeing it, but everything is being pulled from your mind. It was as if it was reading my whole life. It is hard to describe what I really felt there. Your life up to that point goes by in seconds. And I was feeling everything. I remember going down and grabbing a hold of my head and falling to the floor. The next thing I remember, I woke up and I was back in my friend's office in Fort Meade. And they told me nothing happened, that I had been there the whole day. But I knew better. Testimonial. William John Paul Eck was a computer operations and programming specialist in the Air Force in the mid-1960s, first at Pope Air Force Base and then in Vietnam. At his request, his testimony was only to be made public after his death. In 1984, we were tasked to design a security system for one particular project while I was at Egan G. It was a place nobody seemed to be aware of called Tanapa Base, east southeast of a little old mining town of Tanapa. This base was actually where the F-117s were kept when they went operational. They were never kept at Groom Lake. That was only for testing purposes. The entire wing was based there at the time, and our guys used to chuckle about the Revel model not being quite right. What concerned me at the time was a decision that we had to make on what was going on at Tanapa, and that there were a lot of facilities deep underground that we secured. There were elevators that would go up and down. Very large elevators that could handle an aircraft, much like the elevators on an aircraft carrier, but on a land-based environment. These went very deep underground. And the type of equipment that we could see underground was not the usual stuff associated with a normal aircraft. Generators, air conditioners, etc. This was a totally different type of equipment. Several years after I left that project, they finally announced the F-117. One of the concerns I had was, what is being done with Tanapa now? They had moved in a rush, a very big rush. If I remember the number right, there was $75 million spent in only a 9-month period to prepare Holloman for the F-117s. That's okay, but why the rush to get them out of Tanapa? With some of the facilities that were deep underground becoming activated on a full-time basis, not just for testing purposes, they needed to remove those planes and those crews and support staff to Holloman to prepare in a rather large rush for a new project to be brought in at Tanapa. But none of us, including my staff who were installing the security equipment, had any indication if they were readying Tanapa for another plane. Even as something as broad-ranging as the Aurora we'd have heard about, to one degree or another. At Tanapa, you have a base that was very modern, mixed in with equipment that was state-of-the-art. Keep in mind, the Air Force doesn't throw anything away if it doesn't have to. They know how to rub nickels together, they've had to. But the importance of that base can never be minimized. It is very remote. It is between two low mountain ranges. So, from land-based positioning, you cannot see into it. It is even more remote than Area 51, where the ufologists are able to go up there on some mountain top and look at it from 10 or 15 miles away. TANAPA literally cannot be looked at from any direction where you weren't trespassing on federal property at Nellis Range. In fact, the concern for security in the mid-1980s was so severe that one of the generals that I dealt with through Agent G asked me what's the wildest idea I could dream up for doing a perimeter security monitoring system that could look out 10 and 15 miles, and without fail, pick up an intruder. I came up with a synthetic boulder that had a self-powering system in it, where we had special cameras hooked to telescopes. We literally could monitor a jackrabbit at 10 kilometers on a moonless night, and reliably catch him in the camera, and actually take a picture of it. Monitor it. And that was tied in with even some suggestions of how to have harmless roving guards out there on horseback. But they would actually work for another department of the government. These suggestions were taken very seriously. When it comes to the point of creating artificial boulders, and taking a suggestion like that very seriously, with a lot of very complex electronics put into these boulders, of course, placed on strategic cliffs up on the hills looking outwards away from the base, and then linking them by underground fiber or by hidden microwave transmitters, back to a war room at the base. You do not spend that type of money on that type of technology unless you are planning a long-term program there. The military does not waste money like that, in spite of the $65,000 toilet seats. Were the facilities at TANAPA being used for UFO-related hardware or projects? The indication was that what was in these underground facilities, prior to the staff that I would send in to do the work, that they would remove it. There were indications from either the scuff marks on the floor. You can look at a lot of wear and usage on equipment. That there was equipment in these facilities, and they had removed it for my men to go in and do their work. Agent G has a history of a deep knowledge and control of everything in southern Nevada. It is common knowledge. They used to control, and still monitor, the test site itself. They also own the airline that takes the employees every morning and brings them back every night to Papoose, to Area 51, and to TANAPA. So it is not an unusual environment we are dealing with here. We could almost call that Agent G's backyard. The history of the company was from the nuclear testing phases during World War II, and the initial testing afterwards. It was a science company meant to do work for the government, offline, away from FOIAs, Freedom of Information Acts. One of the greatest concerns I have is that if we really want to find out what's going on out there, real legitimately, in the Black Project arena, we need to modify, if we can get it through Congress and the President, we need to modify the FOIA regulations to have no loopholes and to require that all government contractors, even black, are required to submit information through the FOIA system. Because right now, it is a sieve. It's a giant backdoor for them to purposely ignore the requests of either Congress or the public. As for the group that is running a lot of covert projects, my initial view on what the agendas were back in the 1970s and early 1980s was that they were looking to defend the United States, to protect the free world. But the more you look into the situation, it becomes evident that they have agendas that are independent of the goals of the United States. And that the attitudes seem to be one of control. Power and control. I guess you could call that the second oldest profession in the world. The ability of certain groups out there to use force when absolutely necessary, or other controlling mechanisms, to ameliorate the danger of a leak, to control those or maintain secrecy or fear is always there. What happens to Bob in Nairobi, parenthesis, see secret file, unacknowledged special access projects, Paulek testimony, is a situation where I felt that they decided that he was getting too close, and he wasn't afraid, and he was too powerful. And they had to take him out. And they'd take him out in a normal way. Not unlike the strange events with Representative Sif here in New Mexico, who almost never went into the sun because he was living indoors just about all of his life as a representative in Congress, and yet he magically got an aggressive cancer. There are ways to attack that problem. I've talked to some people that were previously SEALs, who went on some rather strange missions. And I've talked to some mercs, parenthesis, mercenaries, because we run across those types once in a while, who have been assigned or tasked with taking out people who were affecting situations in such a way that they are using it as a control mechanism. And these people, because they are duty-bound, will literally take orders and do whatever they're told, a good Nazi philosophy. One high-profile hit on somebody in a specific way. What it does is it puts the fear of God into those that they want to continue to control. So that they don't say anything out of tune. They don't probe where they shouldn't probe, like Congressman Sif was doing. One of the executions that concerned me the most was the death of our Commerce Secretary several years ago on a mountaintop in Yugoslavia. The Air Force hostess on the plane survived because she was sitting on the jump seat in the back. A certain British group went in there first, and she was alive and healthy when she left the mountain, and when she got down to the airport, she was dead. But she only had minor bruises. Someone needs to look into the influence that certain British commando units have, and their cross-pollination with other groups like them in the United States. What was even stranger was that, the Commerce Secretary's body made it back to Dover Air Force Base and they discovered that there was a bullet wound in the top of the head about the diameter of a .45 caliber, and that a preliminary X-ray indicated that there were shavings of some sort inside the brain itself. He was raced out of there into a crematorium literally within a day so nobody could do a serious autopsy. The people at Dover in the Air Force Base there were severely chastised for doing what they did. In the profession, there is a way of doing this with frozen CO2 bullets, or nitrogen bullets. There is no residue left except the shattered pieces of the skull cavity. This is of grave concern to a lot of us, because this seems to be an ongoing process, particularly in the last 10 years. I think we all can just follow the web tracks these days as to where the implications are for that. And the need for continuing control is getting more severe and the use of these mechanisms is becoming ever more blatant. I must admit that any favorable mention of the flying saucers by a scientist amounts to extreme heresy and places the one making the statement in danger of excommunication by the scientific theocracy. Frank B. Salisbury, PhD UFO Secret File Extraterrestrials and Nuclear Incidents Testimonials, Richard Doty. Special Agent with Air Force Office of Special Investigations Captain Robert Salas, U.S. Air Force Major George A. Filer III, Air Force Intelligence Officer Professor Robert Jacobs, former Lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Dwin Anson, U.S. Air Force Colonel Ross Didrikson, U.S. Air Force Merle Shane McTough, U.S. Navy Atlantic Command. Commentary from Stephen M. Greer. There is little doubt that our interstellar visitors were trying to delay our wild push toward mutually assured nuclear destruction when they arrived en masse during World War II. It was no coincidence that Roswell Air Force Base and its 509th Bomber Squadron, at the time, the only wing in the world equipped with atomic weapons, attracted UFOs like bees to honey. Thousands of military personnel stationed at nuclear facilities around the world have seen ETVs. Most, if not all, were threatened not to discuss these events, with the most spectacular demonstrations accompanied by the more severe warnings, or in some case, immediate transfers. This file includes testimony from military witnesses who have courageously come forward to describe the latter. These include a UFO filmed while intercepting an intercontinental ballistic test launch, UFO flyovers which resulted in shutdowns of nuclear missiles inside their silos, and the interception by UFOs of an intercontinental ballistic missile that had been specially developed so it could be exploded on the moon. The ATs intercepted it before it could become exoatmospheric. The thought of a Black Ops mission to detonate a nuclear weapon on the moon leads one to question how much chaos and stupidity will transpire before our species comes out on the other side. We're at the point now where most people recognize that we cannot put off dealing with these energy and environmental issues any longer. Without peace, there can be no further progress on Earth. Now, there are many people who will argue, "Oh, we'll never see peace. We'll always try to kill each other." The truth is most people don't want to go around murdering each other. Unfortunately, we have not been willing to restrain the few rabid dogs that routinely enjoy attacking the flock.